You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, October 8th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Michael E. Mann, climatologist, physicist on the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Also on the program today, the debt ceiling is looming. Republicans would have you believe it's no big deal. Shutdown continues. Immigration protests over the weekend. 60 Minutes also spent the weekend attacking and spreading lies about Social Security disability insurance. Convoy. You hear me good, buddy? 10-4. See you on the 1036. Truckers, right-wingers, intend to shut down D.C. and arrest the government. I'm not kidding. Kansas, still looking to institute school prayer. Apparently, the school system doesn't teach anything about what happens at the Supreme Court. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Just want to let you know that our sponsor this month is Credo Mobile. Now, Majority Reporters know that we try and put our money where our mouth is when it comes to our sponsors. I have been looking for good sponsors forever. Credo has sponsored the show in the past, and fortunately, we got them back. They are the only progressive cell company in the world. Well, at least in this country. I don't know about the other countries. This is really, honestly, the best of both worlds for me. We get to support an organization that fights Republican Tea Party extremists, holds Democrats accountable, funds the progressive movement. Over $2 million they've given to nonprofits, and helps keep this show on the air. It's really easy to sign up now. Go to credomobile.com/Sam. Get 25% off your data for 2 years. They've got true unlimited data, and they'll give you a buyout credit of up to $350 to get out of your contract with one of the big corporate providers. You can go to credomobile.com/Sam. We also have links, obviously, on the front page of Majority FM. Check it out, folks. We're going to go. We're going to talk to Michael Mann in a moment. But first, let's hear this interview from the debut show, the Megyn Kelly show on Fox. Her first guest, I guess, was Ted Cruz.
Texas Senator Ted Cruz is a Republican and our guest tonight. Senator, good to see you. What's it like to be the most hated man in America?
Well, Megan, it's great to be with you, and let me start by just saying congratulations on your new show. Fox News is lucky to have you, and I am honored to have the chance to join you on your very first show.
Thank you very much, sir. All right, so what? Now answer the question.
Look, I think there have been more than a few Democrats who are throwing rocks my direction, and to quote the Bard, "Methinks she doth protest too much."
You know. I believe the bard said something else as well. Oh, if only the sexton were here to write down that I'm an ass. Gentlemen, remember that I'm an ass, even though it's not written down. Don't forget that I'm an ass. Oh, you're a rotten bastard, you are. I'm a wise man, and what's more, I'm an officer of the land, and what's more, I'm a householder, and what's more, I'm as handsome a hunk of meat as any in Messina. And I know the law, damn you, and I'm rich enough, damn you! And I have used to have more, but I still have two robes and lots of lovely things. Take 'em away! If only the sexton had recorded that I'm an ass. Megan. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk to Michael Mann. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Michael Mann, director of Penn State's Earth Systems Science Center and author of Dire Predictions and the Hockey Stick in the Climate Wars. Welcome back to the program, Michael.
Thanks, Sam. It's great to be with you.
So the fifth IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel Climate Change Report, came out, I guess it was now last week, and it didn't, you know, in many respects, it got lost in all of the government shutdown news, but it continues on a path that has gotten, in some respects, more dire, and in some respects, more confident of these the modeling and the predictions for what's going to happen with our climate change.
Yeah, that's right. The IPCC, in this most recent report, the fifth assessment report, has increased the level of confidence from very likely to extremely likely that human activity, the burning of fossil fuels, the increase in greenhouse gas concentrations that has resulted from that, is responsible for most, if not all, of the warming we have seen over the past half century. And furthermore, for the first time, they tied that warming confidently to various impacts of climate change that we are already observing, the rise in sea level, the melting of ice, and the increase in various types of extreme and severe weather events.
Tell us give us the past. I mean, I guess we're talking now nearly 30 years, or I guess it would be closer to 25 years or so of the reports. They come out every 6 years or so. Give us track for us the level of confidence. In other words, when we go from very likely to extremely likely, that actually. That coincides with what?
Yeah, that's a great question because, you know, we tend to lapse into technical jargon in these sorts of reports. And in fact, there is a very specific sort of level of confidence that's attached to those sorts of statements. So very likely represents a conclusion that the scientists are essentially 90% confident are right. There's only a 10% chance of it being wrong. Extremely likely, the way the IPCC defines it, is a 95% level of confidence. That's about as high a level of confidence as we have in anything in science. And as some folks have pointed out, that extremely likely conclusion means that we're as convinced about the reality of human-caused climate change as we are convinced that, you know, tobacco causes lung cancer. It's an extremely high level of confidence, especially given that this is a report that reflects, the findings of thousands of scientists. In some sense, it's sort of a lowest common denominator. It's what all of those scientists can agree upon, and these reports, by construction, therefore, tend to be extremely conservative in their conclusions. And so the fact that the conclusions are this confident and that the predictions are this dire is a true cause for concern, because there really is a level of consensus that climate change is real, is caused by us, and it represents a threat that's as high a degree of consensus as just about anything we've seen in science.
Right. I mean, the idea of being 100% sure of anything is virtually impossible. And I would imagine, too, that the progression of this is also important. I mean, in other words, we have seen a tremendous amount of money and a tremendous amount of attacks. You've certainly been the subject of a lot of those attacks over the years.
Sure.
And so the idea that thousands of scientists would become
right.
more sure that they're doing this in the face of, at least from a societal standpoint, but not so much a scientific one, obviously, a lot of headwinds.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody told you that there was a 5% chance that the plane that you were about to get onto was going to crash, would you get onto that plane? Certainly not. That's an unacceptably high level of risk. And so we can look at climate change in the same way. Yes, there are uncertainties, but uncertainty means that the projected impacts could actually be worse than what climate scientists are actually predicting. In fact, there's quite a bit of evidence that the true rise in sea level may end up being larger than what the IPCC is currently willing to conclude. And so I sometimes use the analogy of fire insurance. The reason we buy fire insurance isn't because we think our homes are going to burn down. It's because if our homes were to burn down, it would be such a catastrophic impact on our lives that it's worth hedging against that possibility now. It's worth paying for fire insurance because this very low probability event would be so costly that it's worth investing in now to hedge against it, to protect ourselves against it. Climate change is the same way. We should think of this as a planetary insurance policy. The difference, of course, is, if your home burns down, presumably you can get it rebuilt or find a new home. If we burn the planet down, there aren't too many other choices available.
And based upon the report, the probability is basically reversed relative to your house burning down. I mean, I don't know what the percentage
right.
of people's homes burn down in a fire, but it's certainly not a 95% chance of likely occurrence.
That's right. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, so that 5% probability, that I was referring to below is, you could look at that and say, oh, well, there's a 5% probability that the IPCC is wrong about this. But that's not that's an unacceptably high probability, for not acting on something.
Will you just go through, tell us a little bit more about the process? Because, we say thousands of scientists, and how does it work over the course of these 6 years as they're developing this report? And it also requires governments to sign off on this report.
That's right. I mean, it literally is the gold standard for scientific assessments of an issue. The IPCC reports, in my view, are really the gold standard for how we go about assessing, a potentially societally relevant problem of science. And so there are, I think, 800 authors this time of the report. And those 800 authors have collected the best available information from the peer-reviewed literature. They've reviewed thousands of peer-reviewed articles. The report went through multiple drafts. I even lost count to either four or five different drafts. You know, there's an initial draft, and then there's a review by a large number of experts in the field who were not involved in the drafting of the report. Then there are a set of review editors that make sure that the authors of the report respond to all the comments that were raised in the review. And this review process happens three or four times. There's an expert review of the first draft, then there are expert reviews of the subsequent drafts, and then there's a government review, as you allude to. And finally, the summary for policymakers, you can think of that as sort of the abstract of the report, the key conclusions described in a way that's accessible to non-expert. That goes through a line-by-line review. Every word of the summary for policymakers has to be agreed upon, not just by the scientists, the lead authors of the report, but by representatives from the various governments who are there and can object. For example, as I describe in my book, with the second assessment report back in 1995, the government of Saudi Arabia objected to the use to the claim that we had now detected the human influence on climate back in 1995, even though the scientists were quite certain about that. They didn't want the report to draw a confident conclusion about the fact that fossil fuel burning was impacting the climate. And they successfully achieved a watering down of the wording. So the report ended up saying there is a discernible human influence on climate change, a much weaker wording than what the scientists advocated for. And that's been true with all the reports. There are, you know, fossil fuel nations. Nations whose, you know, economies are closely tied to the fossil fuel industry, who are heavily influenced by fossil fuel interests, who have often tried to water down the wording in the report. And so the fact that the report is able to come to such strong and confident conclusions is really a testimony to the strength of the, you know, the scientific consensus on this issue now.
And because it goes through that filter of interested parties, whose interests are almost decidedly those who want to downplay the man-made quality of this, it's almost necessarily more conservative than what reality probably is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there literally are adverse special interests, who are adverse to the entire assessment process, who, you know, have fought to water down the conclusions. And yet, you know, the conclusions have, you know, been extremely, increasingly strong with each new report. And we're now at the point where, again, there is a worldwide consensus about the fact that we are warming the planet and that this represents a threat if we don't do something about it. Now is the time to begin, you know, engaging in a legitimate and a worthy debate about what to do about the problem, but we can't continue to deny that the problem exists, as our current House of Representatives is doing.
Right.
The current House of Representatives in the U.S. Has a science committee led by Republican legislators who deny the science of climate change. They deny the science of evolution. I've sometimes joked that we should rename them the House Anti-Science Committee, at least for the time being.
There was we interviewed a writer from Rolling Stone who had done a piece on the fate of Miami, and one of the one of the moments in that piece that stands out for me is when someone who was a consultant brought in to talk about the crisis that Miami was going to face spoke to a Senate lawmaker, told them about this crisis, and then got a 15-minute lecture. I think it was on the book of Genesis. And
it's, you know, it's funny. It would be funny if it weren't so scary. You know, there are legislators in North Carolina and in Virginia. They tried to outlaw use of the term sea level rise in all government documents. Now, it's interesting to talk about Virginia because right now we have a governor's race there between Terry McAuliffe, who is very strong on, you know, he's a pro-science, fact-driven politician, and, you know, he recognizes that we need to have serious discussion about what to do about climate change. And also running against him is Ken Cuccinelli. He's a climate change denier, perhaps best known for having gone after me and the University of Virginia. He tried to abuse his authority as Attorney General of Virginia to subject me and my various co-authors and colleagues to an open-ended fishing expedition, a witch hunt, a subpoena to get a hold of all of our emails, presumably to try to find something in them to embarrass us or discredit us. And so, you know, we couldn't have a more important test right now on whether we're willing to deal meaningfully with the climate change issue than there's this governor's race. And for that reason, I've been actively campaigning with Terry McAuliffe. And if there are any Virginians listening to this interview, get out there, you know, in November to vote for in this election, not just for you know, McAuliffe for governor, but also there's also an attorney general, the Democratic attorney general, Mark Herring, who's very strong on the issue of climate change, and it would be great to have him as attorney general.
Yeah, and of course, you know, other candidates around the country view these type of races and
yep.
get their cues as to what issues have resonance. But just getting back to the report for a second, too, just what is it over the past 6 years that have brought the scientists to the point of being able to go from 90% assuredness that what we're dealing with is man-made to 95%. Is it
yep.
new science, or is it simply that there's maybe less resistance from the governments, or what is it?
It really is the science. It's the strength of the science. You know, as we go on, first of all, the models, the conceptual models that we use to understand the climate system are getting, you know, better and better. We have access to more powerful computers. We can run climate models at very high resolutions now. And so these models produce very realistic-looking weather patterns. There's reason to take them increasingly seriously. And at the same time, with each passing year, we see more of the impacts of climate change. In the U.S., you know, the extreme heat and drought and flooding and unprecedented hurricanes like Superstorm Sandy and large-scale destruction of agriculture in the breadbasket of the U.S. because of the extreme heat and drought and the more widespread wildfires, you know, we're seeing the impacts of climate change with our own eyes. And that makes it extremely difficult, you know, for folks like the Koch brothers who continue to fund a massive disinformation effort to fool the public, to obscure the scientific evidence, to try to convince the public that, you know, climate change isn't real. Well, the problem they have is that people are going to trust their own two eyes. And you know, we are seeing the impact of climate change now in the loading of the weather dice. We're seeing those dice loaded towards more and more double sixes, and we're seeing the cost of that.
You wrote in a piece on Huffington Post that those critics of the report, essentially those sort of professional denialists, have claimed two things that don't necessarily jibe, but that's not really their agenda to come out with any type of consistent critique. It's really just to muddy the waters. But they've said
right.
one that the report is milder. In some respects, or two, that it provides a distorted picture. Walk us through why both of those tacks are incorrect.
Yeah, and it's a great point because those criticisms can't both be true, right? The report couldn't both have understated or have downgraded the degree of the threat and have overstated the threat at the same time, and yet the critics, you know, they can't really find a unifying narrative this time because increasingly there is no legitimate argument against the reality of climate change, the fact that we're already seeing negative impacts of climate change. And so what they look for, as you say, is to muddy the waters, and it doesn't even matter if their various arguments are mutually exclusive or not. They don't care as long as, you know, a particular argument confuses some number of people, they've been successful. And so some have argued that the report had downgraded downgraded their, you know, it was a more mild message, quote unquote. I think that was the claim of Bjorn Lomborg, who's a well-known sort of fossil fuel apologist. You know, he his job is to attack the science of climate change, or to make it sound like it isn't a problem, we don't need to do something about it. And so he argued that the report had downgraded the threat, when by any reasonable reading of the report, we've become more confident that that global warming is real, that it's caused by us, and for the first time, they're actually relating it to impacts that are having a direct cost on our environment, on our economy right now. So by any, you know, reasonable, honest reading of the report, it's a ratcheting up of both the degree of scientific confidence and the assessment of the threat that climate change represents. At the same time, some have tried to, you know, I think I referred to it as a Rube Goldberg contraption, you know, elaborate sort of arguments that try to link various unrelated things in such a way that you confuse your readers to the point where what you say at the end, there's no way they can even tell if it's true or not. And so you've seen efforts to try to argue that the report has overstated the degree of science, for example, by cherry-picking. You know, the critics will take the year 1998, which was extremely warm because of a huge El Nino event, and then they'll try to say, well, look, the subsequent years were cooler than 1998, so the globe must be cooling. Of course, you know, that doesn't stand up to any legitimate scrutiny. That's cherry-picking. It's distorting the fact, taking the fact that there are year-to-year fluctuations in climate that are due to random things like El Nino and volcanic eruptions, and you have to step back and look at the longer-term trends. And when you do that, you see that the globe continues to warm at, you know, the rate it's been warming for the past half century, a rate that'll give us, you know, nearly two degrees Celsius additional warming by the end of the century if we don't do something about it. We already know that even 2 degrees Celsius relative to pre-industrial time represents a potentially dangerous impact on us. And we are, you know, only about a half a degree Celsius, about a degree Fahrenheit from that. To avoid crossing that threshold, we need to bring our carbon emissions to a peak now and begin ramping them down dramatically in the decades ahead. There is a greater urgency than ever in acting on this problem. The science is in. The problem is real. The threat is real. We need to do something about it. We need to have an honest discussion of how we get to where we need to go.
The advantage, it seems to me, that denialists have in this arena is that they don't need to be consistent. They simply need to put out arguments out there just to make the appearance of there being an argument. I mean, the Heartland Institute puts out their, and I just, again, this is one of those situations where I would laugh if it wasn't so horribly sad, but they put out their non-governmental international panel on climate change, which is not peer-reviewed, which does not involve hundreds of scientists or thousands of scientists. By simply putting that out there, it's almost mission accomplished for them because they're saying, look, there's two sides to this argument.
That's right. And, you know, you might not be surprised. Guess who funds the Heartland Institute? Koch brothers and other funders of climate change disinformation, industry front groups, et cetera. That's exactly right. You know, the approach used by climate change deniers is just to throw as much mud on the wall as they can and hope that some of it sticks, and that journalists sort of looking from the outside who don't really have the training to be able to sort out, you know, truth from distortion and falsehood will look at this and will say, oh, well, I guess there are two sides to this issue, and they'll report it as if it is, you know, a debate with two equal sides, when in fact we know that more than 97% of the scientists agree with the consensus conclusion that global warming is real, caused by us, and a threat if we don't do something about it. Back in 2002, there was a memo that was leaked. It was a memo from Republican pollster Frank Luntz, and he was advising his clients, basically the fossil fuel industry, that there was a growing consensus among the growing sort of fraction of the public was becoming convinced that there was a scientific consensus behind climate change. And if they did become convinced there was a scientific consensus, they would demand action be taken. So what he said was, you need to go directly at this idea of consensus. You need to convince the public that the scientific community is split. As long as you can do that, there will be no policy progress There will be no meaningful efforts possible to limit carbon emissions. And so that's what they've done. They know they can't win the scientific argument because they're wrong on the science. So what they try to do is just obscure and throw enough mud out there on the wall and confuse the public to the point where, you know, the public becomes divided on the issue. It becomes just another political issue where conservatives, you know, ascribe, you know, one viewpoint that climate change isn't real. Progressives, you know, recognize that it is real. The public is divided and no policy progress gets made.
Talk to us about the hockey stick. I know that we talked about this the last time you were on the program, but talk about how the report it continues to edify the notion that what the metaphor of a hockey stick describes. Start with just telling us what that metaphor describes.
Sure thing. You know, the hockey stick, you know, and that's the title of my book, is The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. And it's about my experiences at the center of the climate change debate as, you know, a very reluctant and accidental figure in this debate. I was just a scientist who published this result that became iconic in the climate change debate. And so I found myself in the center of the larger, you know, circus that surrounds the issue of climate change. The hockey stick is this curve that we published a decade and a half ago, which seeks to estimate how temperatures changed over the past 1,000 years. We only have about a century of widespread thermometer measurements. So to go back further, we have to turn to what are known as proxy data, like tree rings or corals and ice cores, where we can take these various lines of evidence, these natural archives, and piece together this puzzle of how the climate changed in the more distant past. And what we found when we did that was that the recent warming spike was unprecedented, as far back as we could go, at least 1,000 years. And the curve, which shows this long-term slight cooling trend followed by the abrupt warming of the past century, it resembles a hockey stick. And we are on the blade of that hockey stick, and the blade isn't stopping. The blade continues to get longer and longer as we continue with this unprecedented experiment of warming the planet by burning fossil fuels.
And back in 2001, which was the third IPCC assessment, the length of the hockey stick, as far as science could measure at that time, was about 1,000 years. Where is that? How long is that? The non-blade part, the handle of the hockey stick now?
Yeah. So it's gone. The conclusion has gotten stronger because paleoclimate scientists have pushed the handle back further and further in time. There's some studies that extend it back nearly 2,000 years, but there are a number of studies now, independent studies, that extend it back at least 1,400 years. And what we now know is that the recent warming is unprecedented at least that far back, at least 1,400 years back, and maybe farther. And so the IPCC, in their latest report, actually strengthened the conclusions of the original hockey stick study. The original hockey stick study concluded that the recent warming was likely unprecedented for the past millennium. The most recent IPCC report concluded that the recent warming is unlikely unprecedented for at least the past 1,400 years. And that doesn't mean that if you go back 1,400 years, it was as warm. It just means we don't have enough widespread enough evidence yet to confidently extend those estimates further back. But there are a few studies that have tried to do that, and there's at least one study which finds that the recent warming spike is probably unprecedented all the way back through the beginning of the last ice age, you know, 100,000 years ago or more.
Now, how is that determined? I mean, one of the films that came out the past year, Chasing Ice, was which is an amazing film, both
absolutely.
Visually and, but they used one, I guess, methodology for measurement is taking these ice core samples.
Yep.
What is the sort of the state of the art in terms of how far you can go back?
Yeah. So, you know, with certain archives, certain ice cores can take us back hundreds of thousands of years. And so we can get a pretty good reconstruction of how temperatures changed in Antarctica going back nearly a million years because of some very long ice cores. And there's some long records from Greenland from ice cores. If you're trying to estimate the overall temperature of the Earth or even the Northern Hemisphere, it turns out that those polar ice core records aren't enough. You need to know what's going on in the tropics. You need to know what's going on with the ocean as well as the continents. And so to get an idea of how the average temperature of the entire Earth or the entire Northern Hemisphere varied in the past, we need a very diverse set of records from around the globe. And it turns out it's really difficult to get much farther back than 1,000 or 2,000 years if you're looking for records that are diverse in terms of their coverage over the globe and which resolve individual years, like tree rings or coral measurements. Some of these longer ice cores, there's no ability to resolve individual annual changes. They can only resolve the coarser sort of century-long trends. And so in this one study I mentioned earlier, there was an attempt to use a variety of records which do go farther back, which don't resolve individual years. They only resolve sort of century-long trends. But using those sorts of records, sediments, some ice cores, record old fossil pollen records, they were able to piece together sort of a picture of the longer term sort of slower changes in the climate going back through the end of the last ice age and even well into the past ice age. And in that study, they found no counterpart for the recent warming spike as far back as they could go.
And at the very least, when you take those ice cores as well, you are it has implications in terms of the rate of warming, because as those explain that dynamic on how as the ice in the poles melt, it releases all sorts of gases which then sort of exponentially increase the rate of warming.
Well, that's a good example of how uncertainty could easily come back to bite us, right? Because, you know, the critics will say, well, there's uncertainty in the science. You know, there's always uncertainty, you know, in any area of science. And it's rarely a reason for inaction, for ignoring what the science has to say. And in this case, this is an example of where uncertainty could come back to bite us. We know that there are these potential amplifying mechanisms that exist, like when the climate warms, some of the methane that was stored in the permafrost or along the coastal shelves of the oceans, as the climate warms up, some of that trapped methane is released. And methane is an even more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. So we sometimes call this a feedback mechanism. It's an amplifying factor, and we don't know how large it is. We don't know precisely how much of that, you know, that trapped methane could potentially be released with another, you know, half a degree or a degree Celsius of warming. But it's a cause for caution, because we know that it's one of many reasons for why the changes could potentially be much larger than what the models are projecting, and the impact could be much worse. So uncertainty, you know, is not a reason for inaction, and this is a good example, and there are many other examples of why, you know, uncertainty, just like the uncertainty about, you know, about your home burning down is the reason that, you know, even the small likelihood, the small possibility that your home could burn down is enough justification for purchasing fire insurance. We know enough about climate change to recognize that we need a planetary insurance policy in the form of putting a limit on carbon emissions and reducing our greenhouse gas concentrations.
And speaking of methane, apparently the report also says that methane turns out to be a far more potent greenhouse gas than we had previously realized. This, of course, is incredibly relevant, particularly with the fracking that's going on, and we know how much the vast majority of fracking rigs leak methane just in the process of getting natural gas out of the ground.
Yeah, it's a great example, another example of where uncertainty, you know, seems to be rearing its head in a way that suggests that, you know, it aggravates the problem rather than mitigating it. In this case, you know, there are arguments that have been made that if we were, you know, to continue to, you know, undergo a transition away from coal towards natural gas, getting our energy from natural gas instead of coal. Nominally, natural gas has a lower carbon footprint, by roughly a factor of two, less carbon emissions for each watt of power derived from natural gas versus coal. So you might think, oh, well, you know, moving from coal to natural gas would be one way to begin to, you know, lower our carbon emissions. But it turns out, you know, as you allude to, that it's not that simple. We know that during the process of fracking, you know, hydraulic fracturing, the recovery of natural gas, which is mostly methane, some of that methane escapes through cracks into the atmosphere. And some of that fugitive methane, as we call it, is adding, presumably, to the greenhouse effect. And if those leaks are large enough, and there's quite a bit of uncertainty and quite a bit of debate within the scientific community about how large those leaks are, but if they're large enough, they could essentially offset any advantage of natural gas with relative to coal in terms of the net greenhouse gas emissions. Any gains in reduced CO2 could be offset by an even larger amount of methane that escapes. And
so
it's
in other
a
words,
reminder
it's,
that
so yeah. In other words, it may be better from a CO2 perspective to burn it, but the problem is actually getting it out of the ground. You could very well be more than making up for what you gain in terms of its advantage when you burn it.
Exactly. And there are other, you know, what we call externalities and other environmental impacts that generally don't get priced into, you know, the discussion, but have a cost to us, you know, the degradation of water quality because of some of the chemicals used in fracking. You know, how much is clean water worth to us? Can we even put a dollar value on something like that? And so as we understand some of the potential unintended consequences of various types of, fossil fuel energy production, we're increasingly led to the conclusion that the only real solution to this problem is going to be to transition pretty rapidly away from fossil fuels towards non-carbon-based energy sources, renewable energy. There's a very credible study that was published by scientists from the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration about a year and a half ago that found that the technology exists that could scale up wind and solar and geothermal and other renewable energies in a way that would allow us to meet the vast majority of our energy needs in just a matter of, you know, a couple decades. We need to get on that road now.
And let's just turn for a couple minutes that we have left to the sort of the potential for that. I mean, it was announced, I think, just this week that the White House's senior energy and climate advisor is leaving the administration.
Right.
And I don't know necessarily why, but I imagine that would be an incredibly frustrating position to be in, given the fact that we have a Congress, that particularly a Republican-controlled Congress, that refuses to acknowledge this reality. What has to happen? I mean, you know, from my vantage point, the difficulty here is that on one hand you have scientists who are not trained to go out and shape public opinion, and on the other side you have people whose only job is to manipulate public opinion. They're getting funded to the tune of literally millions upon millions of dollars, and as soon as scientists have to move into that realm, the part of the agenda is already forfeited because it becomes an argument that, you know, just the existence of that argument helps those who want to say, well, we're not sure.
Right.
And so do we need to see more super, storms like Sandy? Do we need to see more civil unrest like we saw in Syria, which many people suggest is a function of the drought and the climate change and the resultant economic impact on millions of Syrians? I mean, what are we going to need to see until we see some action?
Right. Well, yeah, and, you know, with Syria is a great example, you know, of how climate change is what the national security community calls a threat multiplier. You know, there are existing tensions, of course, that lead to conflict, and conflicts around the world cost us greatly in, you know, in blood and treasure here in the U.S. And, you know, we're fighting foreign wars essentially over fossil fuels in the Middle East. And so there is a real cost to us in terms of, you know, national security and the increased conflict that's going to arise because of the threat multiplier of climate change. You know, climate change puts increased stress on food resources, water resources, land resources because of sea level rise. At a time when we have a growing global population competing for, you know, these diminishing available resources, and that is, you know, a perfect storm for, you know, national security, a national security nightmare, really. And so, you know, the military, the U.S. military, recognizes that climate change is one of the greatest threats that we that we face in terms of national security in the decades ahead. The reinsurance industry is extremely concerned about climate change. The damages by increasing coastal flooding events associated with sea level rise and potentially stronger hurricanes is costing them greatly. They're paying out larger and larger amounts of larger claims because of climate change related disasters, not just sea level rise and hurricanes, but wildfires, flooding events. Climate change, by some estimates, is already costing the world more than $1 trillion in global domestic product. Mm. The estimate I've seen is about $1.4 trillion cost to the world every year because of the damages being done now by climate change. And it exacerbates all of these other threats that we face and all these other challenges that we face. So, you know, once again, well, if you look at what's going on in the U.S., as you allude to, you know, we have a Congress right now which is obviously unwilling to consider any sort of climate bill. And so that has forced the president to do what he can in the form of executive actions. And he's made some bold, he's taken some bold steps when it comes to executive actions, like having the EPA put tighter restrictions on carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants. So the executive branch is trying to do something, but what we really need is a comprehensive climate bill, energy climate bill. And the only way we're going to get that is by making sure that we elect policymakers who are going to reflect our needs and our concerns, rather than the interest, the narrow special interests, the fossil fuel lobby that fund their campaigns right now. We need to see a shift in that dynamic, and the only way that that's going to happen is by people getting out there and voting and expressing themselves in letters and op-eds to their local papers and talking to their neighbors and doing everything we can to put enough public pressure on our politicians to make decisions that favor us rather than, you know, narrow fossil fuel interests.
Michael Mann, director of the Penn State Earth Systems Science Center and author of Dire Predictions and the Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. We have links to those books on our homepage at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. Always a pleasure talking with you.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the better half of the program. Don't forget Credo Mobile, our new sponsor. $350 in credit to switch over to Credo so you can get out of your existing contract. 25% off of data costs over 2 years, and they give you unlimited data. That means you can use the new Majority Report app to listen to the show and never have to worry on your Samsung device or your HTC device. Check out their offer. Go to credomobile.com/Sam or just go to majority.fm and click on one of the ads we have on the homepage. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to have Becky Bond on, who is part of Credo Action. She will be talking about the things that they've been up to. One of which, of course, is the ongoing protest against Keystone Pipeline, a huge issue for climate change. When that tar sands oil, if that gets out and is burned, that the top climate scientists in the country, formerly from NASA, has said that it's game over for climate change. So tune in tomorrow, listen to what Becky's doing, get involved at the very least with Credo Action. They're great folks. We will talk to Becky about it tomorrow. Also, you can support this show by becoming a member at majority.fm. If you buy crap through Amazon, buy it through our link. We get a kickback. You just go to the homepage at majority.fm, click on the Amazon box at the bottom of the page, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon crap through that. You won't notice a difference. We get a little kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Join us in the better half, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. I think we'll do a random rush. We'll talk about why this notion that you hear from the Tea Partiers, guys like George Will now, who's Fox News' George Will, that the debt ceiling is no big deal. We don't have to default on our payments. We can simply prioritize our payments. We simply pay off the bondholders on their interest, and then everything's fine. I will talk about why that is a whole lot of nonsense in the better half of the program, because it is. Also in the better half, Cokie Roberts will tell us why it's just really, it's just a bunch of kids playing in a sandbox. I didn't even realize that she was still alive, with all due respect. As Milo would say, no offense. No offense. Also on the program, Convoy, coming to Washington, D.C. to slow down traffic and arrest everybody in government. All that and more, you can IM me. Oh, I had not set up the IM. Sorry, folks. My mistake. We'll be back in a minute. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. The IM machine is now on. All apologies. See you in a minute.